When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Wicked Problems. I'm Richard Delevan.
So the first time I heard about this, it reminded me of a concept that was in Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future. One of the central concepts is this thing called the carbon coin. And so it sounded a little bit like what you were describing.
The idea is to regulate the money supply based on the underlying carbon assets. And the idea, therefore, is that as people go about their everyday economic activity, buying coffee or, you know, buying food in restaurants and just being active in the community, the more people adopt the currency, the more need there is for the money supply. And
so the dream is to get people to fund climate solutions doing things they're already doing. Not telling them they have to eat bugs, stop driving, don't fly, don't use lights, or the things that people looking to delay climate action spin into conspiracy theories to whip up fear and often votes. So what if every time you paid for a coffee, you were directly funding climate action? What if, as in Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future, we literally hotwired the financial system so it would do that? What if instead of gold reserves or just the government-issued debt that backs most currencies today, we decided that the thing we valued most was fixing the climate? From Croesus, the king of Lydia in modern Turkey, was credited with inventing money, to COVID, where in the face of an emergency we remembered we kind of really do, when we have to, what we want with money. And it's an idea that people came up with, and it stuck around because it was a good enough operating system, you could build lots of other applications on top of it at scale. I sat down with Joe Pretorius, who thinks money is due for another refresh. He's one of the founders behind Toko, a digital currency that's not just a medium of exchange, but a powerful tool, potentially, for environmental sustainability. Backed by carbon mitigation assets, held in sort of a central bank. But how do you make a new currency? And is the idea of money backed by carbon credits sci-fi, or does it just seem strange because no one's done it yet? Before we start, one quick thing. If you're a paid subscriber to Wicked Problems and helping support our work, thank you. If you're not yet, but you're enjoying these conversations, maybe today's the day you keep us going by throwing a bit of money in the tip jar at wickedproblems.earth. In an episode about money, I suppose it'd be kind of weird if we didn't ask. Now, here's our conversation about Toko with Joe Pretorius.
I'm here with Joe Pretorius, one of the founders of the Carbon Reserve. Joe, thanks for joining us on Wicked Problems.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So look, my question is, what is a Toko? How many dollars is it going to take for me to get one? And when can I use it to buy a coffee in Zurich?
That's a lot of questions there, Richard. Right, so what a Toko is essentially, it's a, you know, independent carbon-backed currency. So the currency is backed by carbon mitigation assets. Those assets are typically, you know, any kind of tradable certificate, such as a carbon credit or a carbon avoidance or a carbon mitigation. And One TOCO represents effectively one ton of carbon dioxide equivalent that has been mitigated, either removed from the atmosphere or avoided. The exchange rate for the TOCO, you know, has multiple inputs. It obviously depends on the underlying and the movement of carbon pricing. And in the long term, you would expect it to creep upwards as we start seeing more demand for carbon mitigation. But right now, we're sort of pricing that around the 30 euro a ton mark at the moment. It represents, of course, a portfolio of carbon mitigation assets behind it. So it's made up of, you know, both sort of natural carbon mitigation assets and also carbon technology such as biochar or direct carbon capture. And it's going to be available in Zurich from next week. You can download the app at, you know, the Apple Store or at the Android Google Store. It's under TOCO's app. And that will allow you to purchase a currency based on carbon and send it to your friends. You can also offset your monthly footprint by retiring it there. And we're working tirelessly to try and get our first merchants on board. Obviously, once the app goes live, there's no immediate merchants that will be taking it. But we've got a team on the ground that's going to start adopting merchants. And you'll be able to see on the app, there's a little button and a map that will allow you to find like-minded merchants who has come to the same conclusion as people who think that carbon, you know, is a good basis for money. There will be merchants out there that are happy to accept it.
Well, Joe, that was great. Tour de force and trying to get a lot of questions answered in a very short period of time. But let's take a step back. So let's understand what we're talking about here. So the idea is that TOCO is a unit of currency that's backed by assets that are related to carbon mitigation, right? So, and I guess I want to understand the boundary conditions for that in terms of what is and is not kind of considered in play for those things. But it's the idea that this could be the basis for a currency. Now, we've seen lots of experiments with local currency, you know, in different places around the world. What makes this different, other than the carbon aspect of it, but just as a unit of exchange, different from, you know, I'm based here in the UK, so, you know, like somewhere in Totnes in Devon, where they would have a local currency that you can, you know, use in different merchants, you know, works in the little towns like that. How is what you're talking about different? How does it scale?
Well, I think the underlying is obviously what's different. I mean, most currencies most currencies in the world today are fiat currencies, so they really, you know, exist only because, you know, governments enforce legally that they need to be accepted as legal tender. And their expansion is primarily driven by an expansion of debt markets, right? In this case, you know, the idea is to regulate the money supply based on the underlying carbon assets. And the idea, therefore, is that as people go about their everyday economic activity, trying to transact in carbon, buying coffee or, you know, buying food in restaurants, and just being active in the community, the more people adopt the currency, the more need there is for the money supply. And for the money supply to expand, you need to expand the underlying carbon mitigation activity that supports it. So as more and more people adopt the currency, they are effectively placing a demand on the carbon markets, and mm-hmm. therefore incentivizes, you know, guys who run carbon mitigation projects to invest in more and expand that market to support it. So I guess simplistically, you know, I think, you know, it's sort of better money for better world, to put it in a, you know, in marketing speak, because you're able to satisfy your money needs on an everyday basis. But in this manner, it becomes very easy for you to make meaningful climate impact every day without it really costing the individual anything. There's no real additional costs involved, very little friction, but we are now harnessing the actual human need for being an economic actor and tying that back to environmental goals and satisfying that. Yeah. So it's kind of, I think it's just, it's, I don't know what's the right word for it, sort of moral money in a way.
Okay. No, that's a good term for it. So, and I'm just trying to get my head around how the mechanism actually works. So basically there's a nonprofit called the Carbon Reserve, which essentially acts as a central bank, right? And holds assets against which this currency is being issued. It's like, just tell me, stop me when I'm going off track here. But just
so far,
cool. Okay, so, and therefore, there's a limited, finite supply of assets that is backing, you know, this particular currency, right? And the supply of those assets that are under management by the carbon reserve is meant to increase over time. That's the social good that's being promoted. Who pays for it? Who pays for these, you know, kind of, you know, DAC projects or afforestation in Brazil projects or, you know, whatever the things are that are going to go into that portfolio? Who is actually putting up the money for that? How does it actually pay for an increased supply of these projects?
Well, it's actually quite simple. I mean, this is sort of the beauty of harnessing the technology of money, if you will, to translate this demand. So essentially what happens is, you know, as people want to purchase more tokens, they need to exchange their fiat currencies, obviously, for TOCO itself. Mm-hmm. The carbon reserve accepts that fiat currency. It issues the TOCO into the user or the community that is demanding TOCO. It then uses that fiat currency that it has issued to go to the market and purchase carbon assets directly from the market, and it transforms that fiat currency into the carbon asset that the carbon reserve holds. So as the TOCO supply, as the demand for the TOCO increases, the carbon reserves absorbs fiat, it uses that fiat and then uses that fiat to apply it into the carbon market. And that's how it sort of acts as, let's call it an agent, if you will, or a sort of central intermediary surface on behalf of the whole community out there to transmit demand for, you know, more expansive carbon mitigation.
Right. And so the first time I heard about this, it reminded me of a concept that was in Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future, which has been like basically of, you know, we ask guests to come on this show for recommendations of books that have been, or shows or films or whatever that have inspired them in their thinking about climate tech. And all the, almost half of people have suggested, you know, Ministry for the Future as being one of their reads that inspired them to, you know, look, be in the space. And of course, one of the central concepts of that is used as the kind of carrot as opposed to the stick to move kind of carbon climate action in Stanley Robinson's book is this thing called the carbon coin. And so it sounded a little bit like what you were describing. I went back and actually just reminded myself that the original idea was actually from an Australian engineer called Dalton Chen.
That's correct.
Who wrote a paper, and then, you know, he's now got a crowd called the Global Carbon Reward. And they're doing a very different thing, as I understand it. I mean, Dalton Chen is going around actually trying to convince central bankers to change their remit to include carbon mitigation or, you know, abatement as being, you know, kind of part of the reason they should exist. And also then harnessing the power of fiat currencies at scale. And the idea that, you know, he's looking at big global, talking to the Bank of England, talk to the Fed, talk to whoever. Whereas you guys have taken a very different approach, if I'm not mistaken. And actually, as opposed to Chen, you've actually got people who have actually been trading in TOCO, in Stellenbosch, in South Africa, correct? So tell us a little bit about that experiment.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe just on Dalton and the carbon coin reward. I think, you know, underlyingly our concept is you know, they're very similar, and there's been other scholars that has, you know, thought about, you know, this is the way that you can internalize externalities in the economy, you know, perfectly, is by, you know, somehow tying our money supply to, you know, the preservable boundaries of our planet. And I don't think there's a big, you know, sort of philosophical difference between what the global carbon reward is doing and what we're doing. I just think that if you look at the last 30 years that we've had in terms of the carbon markets as they are right now, those carbon markets are a massive failure, right? Mm. They are, you know, fragmented, they're illiquid, they're opaque. And I mean, if you read the newspapers, you'll see that there's, you know, significant credibility concerns among them. And that really means that they remain very small and the pricing there is very, very soft. So it's not really moving the dial at all. And if we're 28 COPs in, and annual emissions are still up by 60%. So the carbon markets and trying to find a price of carbon has failed. And I think our contention is that if you look at the root cause of why they failed, it's because they're very poorly designed, they're very poorly governed and badly supported. And that is because that our governments and institutions have failed to find the consensus that we need for them to create an effective pricing scheme for carbon, right? But when you unpack that, you understand why, right? It's, you know, at a global level, you've got all of these competing national interests. There are several sovereign concerns, and especially when it comes to climate change, there's these skewed vulnerabilities that exist that I think makes it impossible for governments to find the kind of cooperation and agreements you'll need to run this effectively. And, you know, the governments are sort of, you know, they become self-interested actors themselves. So they're kind of transported into this tragedy of the commons themselves. And I think that's the same thing when you start thinking about trying to change the way that the world thinks about money and tying this, you know, tying the basis of money to something like, you know, carbon mitigation, is that we just don't believe that governments will be able and central banks will be able to act fast enough. There's a first mover disadvantage in that, implied in that entire system. I mean, who's going to be punching a hole in their economy and saying, well, I'm going to limit the amount of money I'm going to, you know, supply the market because we haven't reached the carbon mitigation levels that we needed to, when, you know, other countries are willing. And so for them to move forward, I think you'd have to find cooperation at that level, right? And that will just take far too long. I mean, you'll know this better than me. We're out of our carbon budget by 2030, right? I mean, that's what we're facing. So we've sort of taken the view that you need to find a solution that bypasses these institutions, and that you can put the ability to take climate action today into the hands of every economic actor, into the hands of everyday man out there, and democratize the efforts to stimulate and incentivize carbon mitigation. And hence, we have tried to develop the infrastructure and the platform to power exactly the launch of such a carbon-based currency, and say to the market, okay, well, the greater market, people out there, you decide. By choosing this currency, you're opting to divert money need away from fiat naturally into a carbon-based currency. So in a way, the market therefore acts as an allocator of capital towards economic expansion versus environmental protection. And we wanted to put that power in people's hands. And we've developed all of this infrastructure that you alluded to, like the nonprofit that acts as the central bank for the monetary system. We also created a payment system so that, you know, it becomes anybody with an internet connection can access it very easily, and they can just transact. And then last year, yeah, as you said, in February, we took it to a small town in South Africa where I'm from, that you might tell from the accent. Stellenbosch. It's about 40 k's outside of Cape Town, sort of nice wine growing region, large student population. And we launched it there as a kind of test to see, you know, how does this actually get accepted by people? Do they understand the narrative? Is there enough incentive for them to take risk on a new currency if it has this sort of climate impact advantages? And then also, how would the sort of, you know, the business community look at this? Will the merchants accept it, etc.? And then, yes, if you can get a currency going locally, does it actually have the uptake? Are you still there?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not sure what happened then.
Sorry about that. Yeah, no, I just was checking my connection to make sure it wasn't something at my end, but
I think it was my end. Sorry, where did I lose you in that rambling?
No, it wasn't rambling at all. I mean, I think we were just getting into the experience in Stellenbosch to be able to talk about the kind of how things went. So I think you'd set things up very nicely, the kind of community it is and, you know, the kind of setting and the experiment that, as I understand it, you were basically, you know, again, as a former startup guy myself, thinking about it in lean terms, you know, the learning you were trying to get out of it was basically trying to see what were the barriers to adoption, what would make both consumers and merchants decide this was worth doing, and then, you know, what kind of numbers you were going to post. So that's kind of where I was going to go with that.
Yeah, so I mean, on that, to be quite honest with you, Richard, I mean, our expectations were you know, probably at the low end to start off with. Always a little bit skeptical when it comes to human nature.
Sure.
But the results that we got were just absolutely phenomenal and far exceeded anything that we ever expected. I mean, our user growth was like 65% month on month, and we eventually ended up 7 months in with, you know, having, you know, attained about 30 to 35% of the addressable market of users that were using the currency. Mm. And obviously they weren't using it for high value purchases. I mean, it was still being used for everyday purchases of coffee, restaurants and bars. I think what was far more interesting to me were the merchants, right? Because I thought, you know, okay, this is going to be an interesting story. But we'd at the outset decided that, you know, one of the things that we'd need to do is we'd really need to incentivize merchants to adopt this commercially. So we've worked very hard at trying to keep the payment system as lean as we can, so we can offer really, really low transaction fees that is far below sort of current credit and debit card fees. And so initially the merchants sort of hopped on board for that reason. But I think they're very quickly understood that here was this ability to build a brand connection with their customers and a way to signal their, you know, their sustainability credentials to the market. And obviously what happened is, as you know, in a street or a block, if you will, you started having merchants filling in, you started finding that, you know, the users would start preferring the coffee shop that was accepting a currency that was making climate impact versus the coffee shop that was not. So you start created the sort of perfect environment where people had to come on board.
Right.
I think if you look at the total market, that we eventually ended up with just, you know, close to half of all the merchants, but that sort of includes large corporates and large chains as well. If you look at the cohort of merchants that lived in the community and, you know, works there, the sort of more, you know, don't want to call them pop and mom shops because some of them are quite sizable businesses. But yeah, where the owner or the beneficial owners are present, we probably had about 82% of that kind of conversion.
Right.
And that just started creating this real sort of positive vibe where we started seeing increased utility in the token. So now it wasn't only restaurants, it started being bars and nightclubs. We had laundries, we had florists accepting it. So you could do a whole range of activities quite, you know, quite comfortably. Mm-hmm. And that invited more users. And that then created, you know, further utility. And eventually we even had suppliers that were coming into Stellenbosch starting to accept the coin upstream. We had some of the employees working for some of these merchants accepting portions of their remuneration in the currency. Mm-hmm. And what was really fascinating about that was, like, my expectation in the beginning was to say, yeah, we can get people to adopt it, but aren't we just going to see a circular sort of, we're going to sell the token is going to go, there's going to be one transaction to the merchant, and then, mm-hmm, you know, the merchant's going to come straight off back to the carbon reserve, and we would have to give it, you know, fiat back, and we have no net effect. And that was maybe true for the first month and a half. And I mean, obviously the merchants were testing the carbon reserve to see whether they actually pay out.
Yeah.
Whether they would pay out as they were promising. But then they started, I mean, the currency started being retained naturally. And I think it's because, you know, some of the owners could use it, you know, in Stellenbosch further, and we started seeing the velocity of money in the system pick up. Mm. And we've just saw a very steady increase in Toko, to such an extent actually that we felt we were very sort of wedded to the idea initially that we needed to buy the carbon credits and the offsets, you know, in South Africa locally, because, you know, people are very skeptical of the carbon markets, and rightly so. And so, you know, you want to point them into, you know, there's the mangrove forest, you know, there's the wind farm. It's, you can drive and you can go and see it. But we accumulated so much demand that the carbon reserve actually had you know, to pivot out of South Africa because we couldn't find enough credible supply to support the expansion, and had to start importing and buying, you know, buying off the international VCM markets. Yeah, so we had from a carbon mitigation impact, it even though it's a very, very small, let's call it experiment, we managed to transmit significant demand into the carbon markets over a very short period of time.
Okay. And so, I mean, like, those are some great stats in terms of adoption. I mean, and again, at that scale, I'm not going to ask you to get into carbon tons, you know, kind of abated or whatever, because again, that sits 77,000 people, as I understand, in Stellenbosch. So it's not the biggest community on earth. But you guys have gone, you know, you're taking this global now, right? So you're taking this on the road and you're doing pilots in Switzerland and I believe Denmark coming up, both interestingly outside of the Eurozone. So what was necessary for you to be able to get to the point where next week you're going to start, you know, launching this in Switzerland?
Well, I think, you know, as you point out, Stellenbosch is very small, and, you know, South Africa is not, you know, it's not, let's call it a market, where I think there's a whole host of other challenges that probably sit in the addressable market demographic there, and climate change and these things are probably a bit lower. And we've always felt that Europe was our, you know, natural target market, or the developed world where we have the disposable income. So yes, we're bringing it to, there's nothing really much required. We're bringing it to Switzerland and to Denmark. The biggest hurdle in all of these things are getting, you know, is the regulations. So, you know, from the outset, because we're a private, you know, currency and independent currency with our own payment system, we needed to make certain that we are fully regulatable, that we are fully compliant with all the local regs in the jurisdictions where we operate, you know, because we're supporters of financial stability and secure banking and consumer protections and all that. If you want to roll out a system like this at scale, you're going to have to make certain that it's completely interoperable with, you know, the world's current financial infrastructure. So yes, Switzerland was the first place where, you know, we've complied to the regulations of the Swiss, and we're just busy in Denmark. We will be ready in the next two weeks to be able to off ramp fiat for the Toko in Denmark, launch those.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
At the moment, there's a process in Europe that's called the MiCA regulations that's undergoing now. And we expect that to be sort of ready in July, end of August. And then we will have clarity in terms of what it is that we need to do from a regulatory standpoint to comply with the European Union's directives in terms of operating private digital currencies such as ourselves. And once that is there, then we will roll out to Europe. But we will be making the app available worldwide soon, albeit in countries where we haven't obtained regulatory approval yet. You'd only be able to, for instance, buy the Toko to retire, not be able to use it as a payment or a utility token for that matter.
And so, like, I want to come to that because about future plans, but just in terms of how it's going to work and like some of the things you'll be looking to learn. Again, you know, you've been involved in startups, you know, you've had a couple of other ones under your belt, and Fiber and Lobster Inc. And I've never quite got to the bottom of what that was or is, but it's basically the learning that you're trying to get out of these pilots or these, I suppose, launches in Switzerland and then in Denmark is what? I mean, how many digital currencies are you competing with? It's different from, first of all, very importantly, the distinction between this and crypto, right? So we're not talking about Ethereum or Bitcoin where I can, you know, like, I'm just using this essentially as speculation. I'm just want, you know, because I've heard about this, etc. This is a very different proposition To make the distinction between what you're talking about and what people, because people might hear what you're talking about, saying, "Oh, this is crypto."
Yeah, so I mean, we try and stay clear of the crypto moniker. As I said to you, that you know, we're not major. Well, I think philosophically, we're not necessarily aligned to, you know, distributed, decentralized, anonymous, you know, currencies. I think I mentioned to you, you know, in our previous talks that when you're dealing with something like climate change and something that's important, you want to make certain that you don't have a system that is open to moral hazards, which I think that anonymity and that, you know, that takes. Secondly, so we are known quantities. We regulate as if it's a normal, you know, as if it's a normal currency or a normal payment system. Don't go and hide around the decentralization nature. And then obviously we are primarily trying to make this, you know, function as money. And for it to function as money, we are using a little bit of old school sort of, you know, central banking, I guess, philosophy in terms of how we regulate that, and that we apply flexible monetary policy. So we use the balance sheet of the carbon reserve to try and defend the exchange rate and also to manage the convertibility of the currency into the underlying. And that's why we feel that, you know, even though our payment system, yes, is built on a blockchain, one that we've custom developed, and the reasons we did that purely is because we like the technology, because it scales so easily, but we've not adopted many of the, you know, of the crypto, typical cryptocurrencies protocols that sit on top of that.
And so, I mean, because it's the decentralization and the anonymity that allows, you know, is the big difference and what has attracted certain actors to, you know, become very active in crypto, let's just say, and distinct from digital currency and blockchain.
And it invites volatility, of course, that, you know, two things that that cryptocurrencies has is that the monetary policy is normally algorithmic. So it means, you know, it's easy for actors to, you know, to target that algorithm because they know how it's going to behave. And then secondly, that the fact that it's anonymous, et cetera, you know, allows manipulation of the currency to create volatility that obviously attracts, let's call it,
a certain type of actor. Yeah, exactly. We don't need to go there. I think everybody knows what we're talking about. So, and then the regulatory environment. So, I mean, but basically this is a bit like, I guess, an Apple Pay going around and trying to get merchants to sign up for, you know, to be able to use that, right? And so, you know, there's a labor intense process that presumably Apple went through before they, you know, it's Apple, so you're not selling a brand necessarily, but, you know, the idea of it being a payments platform, you know, that's different. So what's the market like? You're going out, you're talking to different merchants in Zurich or in Copenhagen, and you're basically saying, here's the proposition, here's why you should accept this digital currency. You know, what are those conversations like?
Look, I think the conversations are, you know, the conversations are positive. I mean, we haven't had them in, you know, any sort of anger. We've had exploratory conversations because the, you know, the app is just not available yet to yet to use. But I think we find the same thing everywhere, which is essentially to say that yes, we're concerned about climate change. Mm-hmm. Yes, this sounds interesting. We don't necessarily understand exactly how this creates climate impact, and it takes them a little bit of time to get, you know, to get their heads around it. But the fact that it's not costing them anything, the fact that it's very easy to use, and the fact that it has, you know, the stamp of approval from the authorities, in I think that the answer that we're getting is, yeah, sure, why not? We'll give it a go. I think that we're definitely finding that there really is a sense of frustration among people in the community when it comes to climate change, in that everybody wants to do something, but to act as an individual just feels so disempowering and so frustrating because there's nothing that you can do. And here is a means to come together as a community around a shared value, which is that carbon mitigation matters. And we can actually demonstrate that shared value by using it as a means of exchange between us. And of course, the carbon reserves, you know, is there to also give the merchants comfort that yes, we understand that the utility in the beginning is not going to be as great, and that economic needs will take place, and that we will support, you know, your fiat liquidity when and that is required, but that we're here on a collective journey, and that at some point we will start getting the network effects that will make it possible for you to retain that currency and use it, you know, use it in other ways. So yeah, so I think that the overall response is really one of positiveness. We've not encountered the kind of skepticism that we've encountered in South Africa. Let me put it that way. There's a there's a general willingness to lean into this to try and help collectively to solve a problem. And that's sort of the way that we're thinking about the adoption as well, Rich.
Yeah, I can see you. You're back.
Can you still see me?
I can hit. Yeah, you're back. Okay. I tell you what, we could probably, you know what, why don't we just kill our cameras, and that might save ourselves a little bit of bandwidth, if that makes things easier, if that's all right. See if that gives us any more stability. So that, I think I got all of that in the sense that, like, there's a lot of receptivity to the story you're telling. There's a lot of interest in giving it a try, which is great. And so what are your objectives, or how will you know whether you've succeeded in this launch in Switzerland and in Denmark? Like, what are the metrics you guys are going to use, the KPIs that'll say, yeah, we expect to hit this kind of target by, I don't know, end of the year or whatever you're doing?
I don't think we have any sort of specific target like that in mind. This has been, this initiative has been designed, in a sort of non-profit, with a non-profit hat, non-profit hat on. Everything is done really low cost, and we're sort of providing the infrastructure and the platform out there for the community. We will be trying to leverage social media and doing talks and, sort of very leverageable activities to get the word out there, to explain people how it works, etc. But we're sort of hoping to galvanize a movement in these communities of people who really care about the environment, that align with our thinking that, we need to align economic incentives with environmental goals, and mm-hmm. that the monetary framework is the way to do that, and get people self-perpetuating that and growing that way. And yes, we will support it on the, we will support it on the ground, to some extent, to sort of, create an initial cohort of merchants where we could demonstrate the efficacy of the solution. But I mean, the scale that we're talking here about, I think you're going to really need a sort of groundswell of people support, and have this catch the imagination of society at large, and put a solution in society's hands that is cheap and easy enough that people try and adopt this on large scale.
Right. And is this the first of its kind? I mean, I should have asked that at the beginning, but like, is this in terms of like it actually being a functioning medium of exchange backed by, carbon mitigation assets? I mean, is this a world first in what you're doing?
There's been a couple of iterations of trying to create currencies on the back of carbon. The only ones that I'm aware of have leaned much more heavily into the classic sort of crypto space, in creating digital assets there and then running on the crypto exchanges to try and co-opt the demand right there. In terms of building a currency that is transactable every day on an app alongside your Apple Pay and your Visa, MasterCard, that is backed by carbon, I think it is a world first. Right. It's not a world first in idea, but I think in terms of implementation and reality, it is.
I mean, because I think that's kind of what makes you guys stand apart. What makes me interested in kind of continuing the conversation is that it's, people, like you say, people have been talking about this for a long time, and there have been some, frankly, disreputable folks who came along, I think, back in 2018 and created something actually called Carbon Coin. And, they sort of promised to plant a bunch of trees and had just one other flavor of cryptocurrency. And so I think, the fact that you guys have gone around the route of getting, this fully convertible, regulatory approved, in real markets with real merchants transacting, for real stuff, as opposed to some notional Bitcoin account. It's, that I think it's what makes this different for me, and what's, different even from, all due respect to Dalton Jen, somebody who's just going around making presentations to central banks and like, wouldn't it be nice if we could do this? And you guys are actually doing it. And I think that's just what makes it stand apart for me.
Mm. Yeah, I think you need both approaches, right? I think
you need
the people to work on, on the policy measures. I think you asked me what victory would be earlier, and I gave you a fluffy answer. But I think for me, victory would be is that if we could, in a location like Copenhagen or Switzerland, demonstrate that at scale, we can get a community galvanized around using a coin based on carbon, and that using, flexible monetary policy to regulate the money supply so that you can actually affect and transmit that demand responsibly to carbon markets, and that there mm-hmm. is a real need by people to take this kind of action, and they're happy to express it via, you know, via economic action, then I think that that will probably be a kind of beacon result that the policy wonks and the central banks and people would look at. And if that's the case, and from there they decide to, you know, adopt some kind of, you know, carbon reserve system where at least a portion of the fiat money supply is based on, you know, the carbon credits that they hold on the central bank's balance, then that would be victory. If even if we don't exist, let's say, you know, 3-4 years down the line, but we'd managed to create enough of a demonstrable and practical example that this can be done, and then we can get the world to change course, I think that would be victory for me.
Well, I think that's a terrific way of framing it. So, sorry, I don't know if you're stuck for time. I realize I've gone over our allotted time, but I think if you've got a couple more minutes, I had one or two more questions.
Sure.
To be able to get to. So Joe, I mean, I think that's a really interesting, you know, what you guys are doing, I think, is different. And I accept what you're saying, that we need all sorts of approaches to be able to kind of run the experiment in different ways. But I think what you guys are producing in terms of data about consumer behavior, about merchant behavior, is going to be invaluable, as you say, for people who are looking for real world tests of, you know, kind of what, how people will behave when it comes to this stuff. But one of the things that people, of course, will, you know, once you get over distinguishing it from, let's say, less reputable kind of forms of crypto and digital currency, is that if it's, you know, there was a rash of media attention for Dalton Chen in the kind of about, what, 3 years ago at this point, kind of the beginning of 2021. So, you know, Kim Stanley Robinson's book had come out. You know, Chen was kind of doing the speaking circuit, going, talking this stuff up. And there's stuff in Mashable, and there's stuff in plenty of other, you know, media outlets about the idea. And of course, at that time, we were also seeing in the European exchange, you know, emissions trading system, you know, this huge spike, which was continually going up and lasted until February of 2023, of the price of a ton of carbon on the European market, on the ETS. Now, over the last year, that price has crashed in that it's now 50%, you know, it's 56 a ton, where it was about 112 a ton, you know, back in February 2023. So is that a problem for you guys in that the perception of, you know, the idea that there could be a functioning market for carbon has kind of had some, you know, never mind the voluntary carbon markets in general would have had a wobble over the last year, but even the statutory markets have had this valuation crash, you know, from February 2023 to now. Is that a problem for you guys?
No, I don't think it's, it's a systemic problem. Obviously, you know, volatility on the, you know, on the underlying is always something that you're going to have to, that you're going to have to deal with and manage. But I think, you know, in terms of how we look at the carbon assets that we hold, is A, that, you know, in terms of the compliance markets, these certificates are really allowances. So they are a right. They're not actually a carbon reduction. So in terms of their mitigation value, we actually rank them quite low. Their prices might be high, but we think that their, you know, the carbon mitigation value is actually quite low, because they aren't really reductions or avoidances per se. We focus more on the voluntary carbon market and the efforts there and projects there that work towards avoidances and reducing atmospheric carbon and negative emissions. I think the biggest challenge that we are faced with there, obviously, is just these credibility and quality concerns and integrity concerns that has plagued the voluntary carbon market, you know, over the last, let's call it five or six years. But our view is very much that, you know, those credibility and quality concerns has to do with the fact that market is still very, very tiny and fragmented and sort of lives in the dark with very, very little scrutiny. And we know that a lot of people are trying to work at solving the supply side. There's the voluntary carbon market initiatives, there's credible carbon quality initiatives, etc. That's trying to do all of these things. But we think that demand, actually, if we can create sufficient demand and liquidity in that space, then we will create enough economic incentives for the participants in that market, you know, to put in the required auditing, to create the right transparency, to create the sort of, you know, marketplaces where this friction is is lowered, and we can start, you know, sort of, you know, let's, you know, washing out the turds from the you know, carbon market, if I can put it that way, and, you know, start building on its credibility. Our approach in the short term is that we are doing, I think, you know, sort of three things to combat some of that credibility concerns. And the first one is we're taking a portfolio approach. So we want to try and pool risks for the market by buying wide, so that, you know, if any single project or single credit turns out afterwards to have had some concerns, it doesn't affect the overall, you know, the overall portfolio, and the balance sheet of the carbon reserve can take that hit on behalf of the market. The second thing that we're doing is we're taking a risk rating approach to these assets. So we're saying that we have to recognize the fact that, you know, these are voluntary carbon markets. These markets, to a certain extent, are still in their infancy and immature. But, you know, to try and curtail them with high barriers of entry can't possibly be the right approach, right? You've got to give people who want to invest in this space a kind of gliding path that they can come into and then work themselves up. So the way that we look at it is we look at projects, we look at their quality, where they come from, what their history is, et cetera. And then we apply, you know, sort of risk rating to it, the same way that you treat, let's call it, you know, sort of corporate or country debt, and say that certain of these things are AAA and certain of them, you know, are junk credits, but they're all doing something positive. You just need to value the carbon tonnage appropriately. And so we risk discount that as we bring it into, you know, into the carbon reserve to manage that risk. And then the third thing that we're doing is we've created the foundation. The portfolio is there for everybody to see. Everybody knows what the carbon reserve is doing every day. It can see exactly. We publish on the carbon reserve website our holdings, how we've rated them, what they are, with linkages back to the projects. And we invite and we encourage third parties to come and disagree with us vehemently in terms of the views that we have taken, because it is through that sort of market interaction, I think, that we get to a point where we create the kind of market transactions that will drive the quality. And as the quality becomes more evident, that spread will close. Mm-hmm. And as we generate more demand, I think the volatility and the underlying will wash out.
Well, I mean, I think we'll be waiting with bated breath to see how the experiment plays out in Switzerland and then in Denmark. So we wish you guys the best of luck. Actually, one thing that you might be worth knowing, the last time I talked to somebody who was actually the father of a currency, or co-father in your case, was actually Robert Mundell, looking back, the father of the euro, who I interviewed about 17 years ago when he was in Ireland for a thing. So one of the things that he, looking back at my notes in my interview with him, that he was talking about, you know, was that some of the factors that do, you know, make a currency in general successful. So, and in thinking about that, are there any other factors in addition to the kind of groundswell of public support you're hoping to see and kind of community level support? Are there other macro factors that you think, you know, will help determine whether or not a project like yours takes off?
Look, I think that our biggest concern in the, you know, in this scheme really comes down to, you know, to two things. Is one, can you convince a public at large to adopt a private currency such as this? You know, just at, how do you scale this narrative to get to that, you know, two-sided network effect? And then the second, as I just alluded to, I think that there are quality concerns in the carbon markets as they are now. That doesn't mean that the carbon markets are, you know, should be disbanded. They are the right mechanisms for finding pricing for carbon and expanding it. They just need to be cleaned up, and it's whether we can set ourselves onto a path where we can start, you know, where we can guarantee and comfortably guarantee to the public that, you know, when they hold a toko, that toko really does truly represent one ton of, you know, carbon mitigated. Right. I think, of course, the most legitimizing function in a currency always is the moment that, you know, jurisdictions or institutions accept it as tax. So, you know, you asked me, we spoke about victory early, but, you know, in the evenings when I dream about carbon currencies for the future and, you know, how this will be a model for us to actually create, you know, one coherent economic system that, you know, supports both, you know, human well-being, but respects planetary boundaries somehow. When I dream about that, I dream about the day that, you know, governments say, no, it's fine. What we will do is we'll just tax our citizens and our companies in toko to enact and use that as an instrument to enact our climate policy.
Well, that will be an interesting day, and I wish you luck with that dream. Last thing before I let you go, I don't know if you had time to think about this. I mentioned, I think, in our first conversation, we ask everybody who comes on to the show for what we call catalysts, anything that they've read or watched or listened to or experienced that have helped shape, you know, their perceptions and their beliefs about climate and climate tech. So if you have anything for our listeners, that would be great to share.
Look, it's just an anecdotal. It's an anecdotal story that started me on this journey, and I'm not sure. I don't think it's inspirational in that sense, but it definitely was my wake up sort of moment, and that was back in 2017, and I went to a Swiss village called Saas-Fee up in the Alps. And I went on a snowshoe, hike, and we just barely left town. And the gentleman who was leading the tour group pointed to a cross that had been planted back in 1930, and that cross represented the point to which the glacier had extended to back in 1930. And the reason that was such a moment for me is because I then, you know, had the privilege of looking up from the 1,800 meters altitude that I was standing to, up to something like 2,700 meters, to where the glacier was today.
Wow!
And just seeing the scale and the extent of that retreat, the amount of energy that must have been input into that system to create that kind of melt was actually the first moment that it dawned on me that, you know, that climate change is very, very real. Mm. And we might not all be experiencing it, you know, every day we see the, you know, events, but that it is, when you look at it at that time scale, 1930 to now, and you look at that amount of retreat, it is that it is very, very real. And it is very, very large in scale. And yeah, I think that for me was sort of a seminal moment, and it's actually what, you know, put me on the journey to investigate this and try to find solutions of supporting the fight against climate change.
Well, I think that everyone who works in this space has had a moment like that where they just realize that, you know, they have to do something differently with the talents that they have. So thanks for putting your talents into this, Joe, and I wish you the best of luck. Well, hopefully you'll come back and give us an update about how things are going with the pilot.
Yeah, we'll gladly do so. And thank you for having me. It's been an interesting time chatting to you. And it's always nice to talk about, you know, solutions and the fact that, you know, we actually do have the ability. It's in our hands. This, you know, this fight is not lost. It has just begun.
Well, with that, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Joe Pretorius of the Carbon Reserve.
Thank you, Richard. Keep well.
Thanks for listening to Wicked Problems. And if you like this conversation, please share it and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps people find the show. You can subscribe to our newsletter at news.wickedproblems.uk, where you could also find more episodes with Richard Delvin and Claire Brady and all our show notes. And consider becoming a paid subscriber to help support our work. You can also find us wherever you get your podcasts. For now, thanks for listening.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.